Hey, this is Eddie Spaghetti from the greatest rock and roll band in the world, the Supersuckers.
Hey, this is Joe from the Mises.
This is Adam Franklin from Slow Driver.
This is Artie Lang from the Howard Stern Show.
Hey, this is John from the Fags.
Hey, this is Rick Kubik, drummer from Natarose.
This is Josh Hayden from Spain.
Matt Sharp from the Rentals, and you are listening to...
And you're listening to the Dark Stuff Podcast.
And you're listening to the Dark Stuff Podcast.
The Dark Stuff Podcast.
Hey everybody, this is Dave Splash from thedarkstuff.com and the Dark Stuff Podcast. I'm back with podcast number 114. This is part two of my interview with Omaha music legend Derek Higgins. Now, if you haven't heard part one of the interview, let me make a suggestion. Stop what you're doing right now, press pause, because this show will make a whole lot more sense if you heard the previous one. That being said, where this one starts, we're starting in the early 90s, and this is sort of post Derek's band's Digital Sex and RAF. He's venturing into some new areas. We go from this point to about, the current time, actually. Derek began a solo career, and we talk about a number of the bands that he's playing with currently. So this covers, you know, maybe the last 20 years or so of the story. Before we get into the interview, I want to do one little bit of self-promotion. If you haven't checked out our Facebook page, it's facebook.com/ The Dark Stuff Podcast. I've been really bad about promoting that on the show, and so I'm going to start with it now. So again, The Dark Stuff Podcast is on Facebook. It'd be great if you could like it. If you need to reach me on Twitter, I'm at Dave Splash. That's pretty much all you need to know. The website, www.thedarkstuff.com. So without further ado, let's get into the rest of the interview with Derek Higgins here on the Dark Stuff Podcast.
What was going on musically for you at that point? RAF was done, Digital Sex was done. Mm-hmm. You're working full time, mm-hmm. doing this kind of thing.
Recording at home a lot.
Okay, so what was your next venture at that point?
The next thing that happened was that I remember significant was in 90, throughout 93, 94, I met these Japanese guys that were going to Creighton and became really good friends with them. And in 94, they asked me to write some music for them because they were going to start a news service in Japan. And they said they were going to fly me to Japan to work for a summer on music. And so that was the next big thing. What was interesting is just when that was starting to come together, one of our biggest American fans, Randy LeMasters in Pittsburgh, said, I want to remaster and do a deluxe CD version of the Digital Sex CD that came out in France, because the mastering of the original CD is really poor.
Well, digital mastering up until recently has been terrible.
Yeah, it was like, you know, seriously, yeah. So that happened at that same time. So mid-90s, I became activated again. I went to Japan for the summer of 94, wrote music, played one solo show there. I did actually play in Japan. It was amazing. I'm nobody, but there were people who knew who I was in Japan. My friends actually produced a music magazine where there was a written in Japanese this article about digital sex. There's a cover of the CD, and I'm thinking, we didn't know anything about making it to Japan. But that was happening. I was in Japan, and I was interacting with Steve long distance because he was coordinating the new CD version coming out. When I came back from Japan, then we laid down the fig leaves enough, or whatever you call, so that we could start a new version of the band. So Digital Sex started up again in 94.
Oh, okay, okay.
And we started playing out again. Played out at Sharky's. We did a...
Was it just you and Steve and then the same original guys, drummer and whatever, or no?
No, we had a new drummer, Dan Kroll.
Okay.
John Miller, who's not in town anymore. He's an Academy Award-winning writer. John Tingle, who was our original guitar player, was in for a while and then back out. For a while, we had two guitar players.
Okay.
But John was the original guitar player, and he was in and out. So in the 94 version, I think it was just Miller for a while. Then we convinced Tingle to come back, and we had two guitarists. I don't remember how long that lasted. Maybe a year, maybe two.
Okay. And how well did the CD do well? I mean, did you guys find out?
It was a limited edition CD, numbered, I think, an edition of 1,000, maybe.
Okay.
It still, it didn't do well, you know. I mean, it made news. We were able to sell it, but it's still, actually, the label still has them for sale, You know, they, you can still buy it from the label. So, it didn't sell, no. But, you know, what was nice was that the people that liked us really liked us. You know, we did develop a really pretty strong following, you know, small, but really liked us. That was nice.
So, okay, so Digital Sex version 3.0 kind of ends in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
When did your interest in, like, ambient and electronic music begin? Because what you're doing now is very different than what you were doing then, at least some of your projects.
Right, because I'm actually doing all kinds of music still.
Yeah, so let's talk about, you said you started working on music in the 2000s, so was there a period from, say, 95 when Digital Sex ended again? Until then, did you play with bands, or was that sort of an off period and you came back with it?
That's a good question, and I think I did, but it's blurry.
Okay.
So I can't really remember between 95 and 2000. Oh, yes, I was in a band called Akita Manio. See, I've done so many things. I was in this world music band.
Okay.
Okay, with a didgeridoo player and a Native American holy man flute maker. That was in 97. Now, okay, see, okay, so that's what happened, okay? But my interest in electronic music goes back to childhood. My older brother and I we'd go to the library and we would you know, he turned me into Stravinsky. And then he, from the library, he borrowed a Terry Riley album and a Steve Reich album when we were just children, and also Stockhausen, and I got it. My mind was blown. So my interest in electronic music and ambient and space music goes all the way back to my childhood, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you just sort of started actually working in that medium, sort of.
In the 80s.
In the 80s. Okay.
Yes, actually have tapes of stuff that I was making back during the Digital Sex days that you hear it, you know. I didn't put any of my ambient pieces on the Digital Sex album. There is an ambient piece on the album. Do you have the Digital Sex?
I don't, no.
Okay.
No.
I should try to get that to you, a CD anyway. The record is pretty collectible. But Tingle made an ambient piece for the album because he and I go back to childhood, you know what I'm saying, and we were both into space music, you know. So I was making space music back then.
Interesting. Okay, so we hit the 2000s, mm-hmm. and now you start making some of the records.
This is what happened.
Yeah.
In the year 2000, so, I think it was something about, honestly, it was something about Y2K being a complete hoax, but that was on my mind a little bit, you know? So it was like, okay, so we're here in the 2000s. What do I really want to do? It's like, well, I want to keep making music, and I want to put something out, and I've been making all these home tapes, and so that's what I had to work with. So I made my first solo CDR, and I started working on it in 2000 and actually had it produced in January of 2001. And that led me to starting my own little label, DVH Recordings, and releasing my first proper CD in 2004. And to me, 2004 is the beginning of this current the stage of solo artists. Yeah. I've lived elsewhere.
Did you ever consider, you know, moving to another town and seeing if something would happen maybe at another level, or you always wanted to stay here?
I never wanted to move to make something happen.
No.
I've been a big absorber of music, but also music trivia and looking at the music business. And before I was in Digital Sex and I made those records, And I was sending them out to get reviews. I was also sending them to record companies. And for a time, I was trying to pursue the music industry. The more I learned about it, the less I liked it.
Yeah.
And so I just went back to square one, which is, what is it that I really want? Do I want to be famous? Do I want to be on a label? No, I want to make records. I want to make music and then have something I can play and show and give to people. So that's why I've stayed here, because it's affordable. I've traveled. I've played elsewhere. If it was feasible, at one time I would have liked to have lived in Europe, but now everything has gone to shit economically. So it's like, why? I'm able to stay here. But I never wanted to move to make it. Whereas my brothers and sisters, two of my sisters and my older brother, they all moved out to California to make it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were into that idea. I thought, this is ridiculous. This is not for me, no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of these things, you know, someone said, made this phrase, well, if you can't make it in your own town, what makes you think you're going to make it somewhere else? Well, I don't know. Definition of making it is very...
Thank you.
It varies.
It does, you know, it does.
It's all in your mind. What do you consider your own sort of level of success?
It's completely...
And what are you happy about, you know?
Yeah.
If you are making an album and you're selling 50,000 copies, that sounds pretty awesome. But then, on the other hand, if you're pissed because you don't have a gold record, well, you're not making it in your own mind. You're failing in your own mind, you know?
Exactly. Or if you're under so much pressure because you didn't realize what you signed up for, that's the thing I realize, is that success wants more success. It's not pleasant or personal, and you become a commodity of your own thing and pressure, and I don't want it. To me, it means a lot. I'm maybe idealistic, but even at 59, it's like it means more, the actual doing, than I got a gold record, I got $50,000. I'm broke right now, literally, but I am a star in my own mind. I'm very happy.
That's good. I mean, you know, that's ultimately what matters.
I'm very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, very
so,
happy.
So, okay, so 2004, we're starting to do this new kind of stuff, mm-hmm. self-releasing mm-hmm. music, mm-hmm. and I guess what, you're now in a bunch of different bands at this moment, so I guess give me the sort of the play-by-play of what was going on from, like, the mid-2000s
okay.
up to where we're at now, and then your newest record... is Flyover,
yeah.
which people can't see because this is audio, but it's right in front of us here, but that's the newest release. So get me from about 2004 to where we are.
Okay. So after I made the Nice CD, R, and felt pretty good about it, I decided that I wanted to make a proper album, because the Nice CD... was the best of what I could call from my home tapes that I'd been recording all through the 90s, okay? And I'd been recording a lot of that stuff on four-track cassette at home, just trying to make the best I could. And so, you know, a lot of warts and stuff, okay? So for Derek 2 in 2004, I started working on that in 2002 and 3. It took me 2 years to finish it, you know. But then I decided to have it manufactured, not a CDR. I decided to have an actual... you know, standard CD made and the whole thing, get a barcode, and I said, okay, I'm starting my 10-year plan, because it takes 10 years to make it, basically, you know, in the music business, it really does. And so I said, okay, I'm starting my 10-year plan because I'm not done with this. And I decided to myself, what is it I want in 10 years? And it's 10 years now. I said, well, I want to be an established name locally. I'd like to be... living more on my music than not, and I want to feel like an artist, and all those are true.
Yeah,
I'm still working on making money and being good at business.
Sure,
but those personal goals have already been fulfilled, and they continue to it continues to build. So, I made the solo CD. I started doing solo shows, not real regularly, but intermittently. Akita Manio was still going for a while. And then... I can't remember when I met Nick, but I've known Nick for 7 or 8 years now. I would actually have to look in my... I should have maybe studied my own shit here, you know?
So Nick Thacker, for people who don't know, he's a filmmaker from Omaha. Mm-hmm. He's also in Icky Blossoms.
And in Dreamland.
And in Dreamland.
Yeah.
the point where we are now. So, in the present, you're doing exactly what you want to be doing.
Well, can I tell you the story of how the label started? Because it's pretty good. Okay. So you know that we're in the vinyl community on YouTube.
Yeah.
Now that's part of how this happened. Back in about 2005 or 6, I'm just on the internet on YouTube looking for stuff, and I decided to look for record collectors. And I came across, I've discovered people who were showing their record collection, okay? And I had been, I didn't know this, but it was something I'd always wanted because I'm a big collector, okay? I said, I found my people, you know? So I started making, I got the guts up and made my first video saying, okay, well, I want to do this too. And it just snowballed, and by the year 2011, I had made a video of my discography, of my own discography, because people, well, I did it for myself, and then people got interested in what I had put out, you know. And my third album, Derek 3, I only made as a limited edition CD. There was only 200 or 300 that I had made, okay? So I was already sold out of it by the time I'm showing it in the video. And people said, well, I'd like to get a hold of that, okay? So I said, okay, well, I'll tell you what, I'll make a limited run of CDRs and see how it goes. So I made 25 of them, and they sold out in one day.
Wow.
Okay, so I said in the next video, just jokingly, I said, well, you know what I'd really like to do is put this out on vinyl, but I can't afford to do it. Within an hour, I got an email, how much you need? This guy from Florida loaned me the money, and I said, I guarantee you that you'll get your money back. And that's how my record label proper started, okay? That's how the vinyl started. My first releases, starting with the one in 2004 on DVH Recordings, was a CD, but it was the vinyl community that made it possible for me to start making records.
Wow, that was actually a question I was going to ask about when you got involved in that. So that part's answered. When did you actually start collecting records?
I started collecting records as a little boy, but because of all sorts of madness in my life, I've destroyed, sold, and given away almost as many albums as I have now, and I've got about 10,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
My whole house. I sold that's probably one third of what I used to have. I sold two thirds.
And your cat.
I know. That's a cat who's no longer with us. Scratched up. That was where all the K's were. So my Kiss records all got destroyed. Kinks, a number of other records.
Oh, man.
And, you know, it happens so slowly. You don't even notice they're doing it until all of a sudden they're destroyed.
I got a bunch of it, too.
This one doesn't do it, and the other one doesn't do it, and I'm happy about that. But, boy, yeah, that was a tough one when I saw that. But, no, I sold about two-thirds of my collection probably about 13 years or so ago because I had a tremendous amount of debt from my record label that, you know, was basically a failure.
Yeah,
I had a lot of good music, but I was not smart business-wise, and I didn't set it up in a corporation. It was a sole proprietorship. Mm. It was just me.
Yeah.
So that means all the debts are mine.
Boom.
And so I had to pay it all back. And I sold a huge chunk of my collection. I mean, Nirvana saved me because I had every picture disc. I had every single pressing. I had all these different things. And that was about the time where there was just this massive new interest in it.
Right.
And I got it at a good time. And I was able to make
money. Did you meet them? Did you meet them?
I met Kurt Cobain one time. Mm-hmm. I lived in Seattle from 92 until 94.
Okay, cool.
And the day that In Utero was released on vinyl, back in 94, they put it out 2 weeks ahead of the CD. Because they were already starting to make vinyl just a goofy collector's item and not like a legit format anymore.
Right.
And so they would do this. They put out In Utero 2 weeks ahead. So I walked to the record store and I see this guy in front of me. And it's summertime. If I remember correctly, it was like August. So it was very warm. He had a winter coat on. He had one of those hunter's caps with the flaps over his ears. And but he turns a little bit to the side, and it's him.
It's Kirk.
Okay, and he's standing there, and he has a copy of the album. And he's waiting in line to
buy his own
it.
Record,
And I'm just like, this is so unbelievable that he's doing this. This is the biggest rock star in the world. He's standing here. Nobody even is noticing it's him.
Yeah.
And he's buying his own album. So I just tap him on the shoulder, and I'm just like, hey, don't you get, like, a free one of those or something, you know?
Great question.
And he said, he just goes, my record company never gives me anything. And then it was his turn to go in line,
awesome.
Paid in cash, took the record and walked out and never saw him again.
Yeah, I've met him too. Yeah.
I mean, it was just so bizarre seeing him there.
That's cool. That's a great story, too.
Buying his own album, you know? I couldn't believe
that. That's a great story.
I've never met any of the other guys from that band.
Chris, I met Chris. I met Chris, yeah.
Actually, I was at a party where Chad Channing, one of the old
drummers. Yeah, that's who I saw was the original.
But I didn't know. I was thinking it was him, but I didn't want to ask because I thought, because this was still in the early 90s when Nirvana still existed. I thought it might be a sore subject for him.
Gotcha.
I didn't want to, like, approach the subject. But later on, I found out he did live in this place called Bainbridge Island, which is where we were at. I was at a party on Bainbridge Island. So I deduced it probably was him.
Probably was him.
Yeah. But I didn't want to bother him about it. And, you know, I think, you know, in case he was real sensitive about it or something like that. So.
Cool.
Okay, so you've been. What do you think is the most valuable record in your collection? Not just from a financial perspective, but also from a personal perspective.
Well, I still don't actually know what I have that is super collectible, because I have kept some records where they're really obscure, and I'm thinking this has got to be something I still haven't heard about it. One record I know that's pretty valuable is this German spacewalk album by Achim Reichel and Machines, Echo. It's starting to show up now, every now and then, usually in the $300 to $500 range. But several years ago, I started to document my collection on Flickr and Wire magazine. You know Wire magazine. They contacted me and asked me if they could use the picture of my copy of Echo because they couldn't find one. So my picture of my album is in the Wire magazine article about krautrock, and I haven't priced it lately. I think sometimes people get lucky and find it for low. But that's one I know is real, is monetarily valuable. I probably there's a single from a local band called L.A. Carnival that morphed into the band Kraken, and then the leader of the band won a Grammy for helping to write one of the Doobie Brothers' biggest hits, I think, Minute by Minute.
Oh, wow.
Les Smith, he was in that band. Their first record was a 45 that they made here in Omaha. Only had 50 copies pressed up. I have one.
Wow.
That I know, and I have people all over the world that contact me regularly. You think about giving that up, you know? And we're in the four-figure range for that one.
Wow.
And I don't want to sell it.
Okay? Yeah.
Now, when it comes to what's personally valuable to me, my progressive rock collection, the records that I got as a teenager that I managed to hang on to through my mental illness, like Soft Machine and Faust and Gong, and early Genesis, those records have a lot of personal value to me. Both have a total kick. I love recording because I can do it at any time and I can just get lost in it. But I love playing live. I've had a lot of bad experiences playing live, but when you connect with the audience, there's nothing better. I love them both.
Okay, so to get for people listening where can they find your stuff and how can they contact you?
The easiest way to find my stuff is I'm on Bandcamp, Derek Higgins Bandcamp. Okay. I don't have a proper website, so I use a blog, you know, DVH Recordings. I don't have a proper distributor. Indremo is distributed through Team Love, so that's available internationally. But the best way to get a hold of my records is directly from me.
Okay.
I'm still working on that part, actually, Dave, because, again, I don't mean to be too much of an egghead idealist, but I'm doing the thing that I really want to do, which is to make the records, get it to the people. When I made Nice on CD in 2000, I spent a lot of time and money getting it out to get reviews and stuff, you know? And a certain part of that was really disappointing.
Oh, wow, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So, see, this is like, it's very self-indulgent, you know, this is for me, you know, I want
still,
this. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But it's gathering steam, even by word of mouth, you know, it's like I can't afford a publicist, I'm not good at doing business, it's real easy for me to not, like, I just sent out a press release, but I only sent out a few, and I need to send more, but it's like, it's not what I'm focused on, you know.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is that, where, like, for example, the Faint are real business savvy and they know exactly A, B, C, D, and this is what we're doing, I'm still slightly nebulous there, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm still getting that part together because I'm doing what I really want to do, which is making the music and getting it directly to the people. I'm really not interested in business. It's a necessary thing, you know.
You got any thoughts about trying to see if any of your music could be used in films or commercials or
well,
TV
that's,
shows or
yes.
something like that?
Okay, so let's backtrack a bit. I need to find out about licensing, you know. I need to pursue it. I do, Dave. I don't really want to.
Yeah.
It's
a double-edged sword. It's something that up until a few years ago, mm-hmm. I would have looked down on an artist mm-hmm. for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, because it's so hard to make a living
Survival.
In music, it's sort of like, you got to do what you got to
yeah.
do. And,
yeah.
you know.
So I'm trying to find out about it slowly, but this is actually a soundtrack. I did my first film soundtrack
okay.
to the locally produced independent film Flyover Country. Did you hear about that at all last year?
I've seen the poster in your videos
yeah.
and stuff, so that's
yeah, really small budget, first gay-themed film probably to be made in Nebraska. And I was really flattered because Jim Fields, who wrote and directed the film, he got a hold of me. He was a fan of mine. He said, I like your style. I'd really like you to write the music for my film, you know? And he paid me nicely. I mean,
Was that considered the soundtrack there, or is there a separate soundtrack?
There's a separate soundtrack that... Okay, let me try to explain this. So when he hired me last summer, it really inspired me, and I presented him over 70 different pieces of music to use, okay, for the film. So he only ended up using about 13 different pieces, and I told him probably what I'm going to do is use the stuff that I give you for the film that I really like for my next record project. So this is some music that's in the film, but different versions of it, and all the rest of this is music that I submitted to them, but they did not use,
okay.
that I worked up for this.
Now, were all 70 pieces that you said, were some of them stuff you had hanging around, or was it all brand new, I'm writing just for the film?
I wrote 70 new pieces of music last summer.
Wow. Now, is some of that 70 that you haven't used stuff that you're planning on...
Yeah, I've already got... Yeah, it's like... So, where we're at now is... I was a mental health specialist working up until 2011. It was driving me crazy. But I waited until I had enough money in my retirement that I knew if I turned it in early, I'm going to get penalized. But I had enough that I could pay my house off. I planned this because I was going to lose my mind standing my job, you know. So I quit, paid my house off, and then I started using turning around. I would take the profit, the money from the previous record, and just, I wouldn't put it in my regular account. I'd keep it separate, you know, and just turn it around to make the next record. I've made 7 albums now. I've produced 7 vinyl albums. But my retirement ran out. And so on this album, I've literally had to resort to living off the money that I made off of it, so I don't have enough money to make my next record. So I'm going to do an Indiegogo campaign. But I already have the music. I have enough music for 3 albums right now. I need to do a final sequence and then master the next album. Yeah, but I've got enough for 3.
Okay.
I just last month I wrote 27 new pieces of music, not all complete, but about half of them to the point where I just need to mix it down. Yeah.
No, so, okay, so we'll wrap this up here, but in terms of what you're doing at this moment, who are you playing with at this moment? All the groups that you're in.
At this moment, Indrima is still going.
Okay.
At this moment, I'm in an avant-garde improvisational band called Hotlines. We have only played once this year so far. Do you know who Luke Polipnik is?
I don't know.
Okay, or Amanda DeBoer Bartlett?
I might have met these folks. I'm okay. Bad with names. So
well, yeah, these guys jazz, classical music. Okay. But, like, so I do that with them. I'm in RAF. RAF is active now, okay? We are active, although it's kind of like I can't say we're back. Right. I want to say we're back, but we got a gig.
How many of the original guys are still with the group?
It's
still, well, I guess you weren't an original, you said, but from that period when you were in the band, how
it's
many
us. Guys are still? It's us. Okay. It's us. And we, this last show, we got Matt, the original singer, to come and rehearse once. So we have two guys who were in the band, Jimmy Scaffa, as the new guys in. Like, Kelly is our new singer, and then we have a second guitar player now. But the other three are the originals, you know, Tim and Paul and me. I am doing my solo shows. I'm doing the Under the Radar this weekend, which won't matter for this, but that avant-garde music festival that's happening, I don't know if you even heard about it.
I don't think so.
Yeah, Under the Radar. It's happening at several venues throughout Omaha starting tomorrow through Sunday. And I play Saturday twice at Slowdown. One solo set and one set I'm backing up the dance company TBD.
Okay.
I have a solo show coming up in August at Almost Music. So, yeah, I got to just get this straight. Indrima, Hotlines, RAF, solo. Strange Attractor is a band I just joined.
Okay.
And we've only done one show so far, and that's in development. I'm mixing the recording, the CD that we want to put out. So that's another project I'm involved in.
Wow. So still keeping extremely busy.
And I'm 59.
Still got multiple bands.
And I'm 59.
And 59. Well, thank you very much for doing the interview.
Thank you, Dave, for having me. This has been great.
Absolutely.
There you have it, the end of part two of the Derek Higgins interview here on the Dark Stuff Podcast. Hope you enjoyed the show. On the next Dark Stuff Podcast, number 115, I will be interviewing a guy named Dave Rosenheim, who is the singer of a San Francisco Bay Area band called Winchester Revival. Now, that's a pretty new band. I've known Dave back since the 90s when he used to record with a great band called Hue. We'll talk about his new group, talk about the past, and we'll get into some details about why exactly I've known this guy for so long. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been the Dark Stuff Podcast.
Transfer of data is complete.